let's begin with the charges themselves, starting with the most serious, the criminally negligent homicide charge. What do prosecutors have to prove with that charge?
Well, they have to prove two very important pieces. They have to prove, of course, that what the defendant did actually caused death. And then they have to prove something about the defendant's or the accused's state of mind. And when it's criminally negligent homicide, that means they have to prove that she either did realize or should have realized that by doing what she did, there was a risk that the person she was attacking could die.
And going back to the charge itself, the AG's office says that this charge is the one they went with in large part because the medical examiner's determination was that the cause of death was a pre-existing heart condition.
Right.
In a lot of ways, does that essentially make this as serious a charge as they could reasonably bring in this case?
Well, it really has to do with what they can prove about her, the assailant's state of mind. That's what it boils down to. And that really would have to do with what they can prove about how serious an assault it was, you know, what exactly she did, what she used, if anything. And so, you know, what I think the fact that it was actually that because there was a heart condition, it contributed to this, you know, probably makes a difference mostly because it may be that the actual assault wasn't what would ordinarily cause death, but because of her condition, it did. And that might then impact on the state of mind of the attacker. In other words, you know, nobody would believe, even a reasonable person wouldn't believe that what she did, even though it was wrong and it was violent, that it would actually cause death. So, you know, a punch or something like that ordinarily wouldn't cause someone to die. And so that suggests that when doing it, the person didn't intend to cause death. So I don't think they believe that they were able to prove anything more than just that she should have realized it was a possibility.
And I guess the other part of this is that the DOJ says it's going to try the girl charged with negligent homicide as an adult. How,
yeah.
In what way does that impact the case?
Well, it certainly impacts the defendant's situation. You know, if it was a if it was all tried in family court, it's a much less serious matter, and the consequences are much less serious for the defendant. It's also a much more formal proceeding in adult court. There's also a jury, unless it's waived in the adult court, where there wouldn't be if it were tried in family court. So it has a big impact. And, you know, it's, I think, you know, ordinarily a prosecutor's office has to make a choice and use discretion about whether something that could be prosecuted as just in a family court matter deserves to be in the adult court. So it's really a very important choice they made here.
Is there a sense also that maybe that this also shows how seriously the prosecutor's office is taking it by elevating it to this level?
Yes, definitely. It's, you know, where they decide that the behavior warrants the much more serious treatment that you get in adult court. The consequences, the imprisonment, the location of imprisonment, you know, the potential for supervision over many years, even after incarceration. So it definitely reflects that.
The other charge for the other two girls involved is a third-degree criminal conspiracy. Just give us a little sense of what that is and what prosecutors have to prove there.
Yeah, well, conspiracy is what we call it inchoate offense, which of course means that it doesn't matter whether they prove that anything actually occurred. It's just the planning and the agreement. The essence of a conspiracy is an agreement. Now, I don't think they can prove or will even try to prove that there was an agreement to kill, because in order to do that, you'd have to prove an intent to kill. And there's really no suggestion here that that's possible to prove in this case, that the girls had an intent to cause death. But there was apparently some evidence of a conspiracy of a plan to assault. And so they would have to prove that there was an agreement between at least two people to assault someone, and that there was some, that they did something in furtherance of that. But the evidence of what they did can be very small. And in this case, the video, my understanding is, shows that the two girls being charged as juveniles didn't actually take part in the assault, but just even being in the room is enough for the conspiracy.
And I guess, again, this kind of goes to the idea of this is about as serious a charge as they can perhaps bring in this case against those particular girls.
Yeah, the only other thing that they may have talked about bringing, I don't know, is whether they could be accomplices to a homicide. And that's not a, you know, an inchoate offense. That's a completed offense. But I think that they probably chose not to do that because, the proof of what's on the minds of the accomplices is a pretty stringent requirement of proof of either, you know, intent or knowledge of what's going to occur. And it probably didn't rise to the level, the proof probably doesn't rise to that level to prove that they were accomplices to a homicide. But, you know, if this were all in adult court, a conspiracy is punished almost always just as severely as the completed crime. But I think the fact that they chose to do their prosecutions in family court as juveniles shows that they don't think that it's warranted to take the more serious step of going to adult court with these young girls.
And it would seem, you're discussing intent and trying to discern what the intent was, and it would seem just based on what police have told us in terms of how much time they were taking with the social media aspect of this, that social media evidence is apparently playing a significant role in this case. Is the use of that type of evidence becoming more prevalent in trying to discern intent?
Yes. Yes, very much so. You know, it used to be years before this that it was, you know, very difficult to prove intent. And if a defendant didn't admit to law enforcement what was on their minds when they committed the acts, it would be really hard to prove. And now, because people so frequently discuss their thoughts and plans and motives in public, there's a lot more evidence of it. So I think they have used that quite a bit. I haven't seen any indication that there's evidence that they talked about causing a death. Mm-hmm. The evidence may show that they were planning to assault the decedent, but it still may not show that they even recognize that there was a possibility of death. What would be very important here, and I haven't seen anything from what I've read to suggest that they have this, if they had some inkling that she had a heart condition and therefore was particularly vulnerable, that would be very powerful evidence because it would then show that they recognize the risk of death. But without that, the jury in the case of the one being tried as an adult would have to find that, you know, a reasonable person would have realized there was a possibility of death. And, you know, that may not be that easy for them to prove.
And going back to the social media aspect of it, it does, I guess, open up some windows. But by the same token, is there some difficulty also sifting through that social media evidence and maybe separating fact from rumor, hearsay, and
yes,
those type of things, just like you would in almost any other case in dealing with what people say to each other?
Yes, absolutely. So things that the accused wrote themselves, as long as it can be authenticated that this is something they actually wrote, that's almost always going to be admissible. But things that other people, other parties that are not the accused in the case say to each other or about the accused, there are lots and lots of rules of evidence that would have to be overcome, if they could be, to get any of that in. So the evidentiary questions are key, and a lot of that probably wouldn't survive, you know, the hearsay rule or, you know, some other rules of evidence with regard to authenticity. And so it's a lot to sift through, and it certainly can help a prosecutor or the defense in their investigation of the case. But to actually use it in court, you're right. It doesn't mean that everything that's online or everything's in social media comes in. Not at all.
And I guess that's where we're seeing a lot of the difficulty between what the public perceives is going on here versus what will actually happen in the courtroom and what will actually be the key points in a court case.
Yes. And in the case of a jury trial, big challenges, you know, people have been reading about it for so long, and then when it comes time to picking a jury, the idea is to find some jurors, hopefully who haven't read about it, that may be impossible in this case, or at least haven't formed an opinion about the case, and that's challenging. So, you know, that's always the case where there's a lot of publicity, this case isn't that different from others in those terms because, you know, there's often a lot of publicity around a case, whether it's social media or, you know, TV or newspapers, that's always a risk when something really captures the attention of the public.
And to that point of this being such a high-profile case, I'm curious, would charges like this, criminally negligent homicide, criminal conspiracy, be ones that, again, if this was not as high-profile, ones that prosecutors might be more likely to pursue a plea deal than to go to trial?
Well, you know what? Prosecutors pursue plea deals, and so do defendants and defense mm-hmm. lawyers in almost every case.
Okay.
Now, when there's something that there's a lot of public attention on, it just changes some of the dynamics. It doesn't necessarily mean there won't be plea negotiations. It just means that everyone's looking much more closely at it, and it's just not a matter of the victim or the victim's family's feelings, but public perception and, you know, sometimes protest or outcry. So it impacts it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to happen. You know, it depends. I think at some point, you know, as both sides start working on their cases, they may realize that there's strengths and that there's weaknesses. And I wouldn't rule out the possibility of some sort of, negotiated plea in the cases. But you're absolutely right. When there's a lot of scrutiny from a lot of different parties, it's just factors in. Doesn't mean that they won't happen, but it'll factor in. And, you know, they will be very concerned, I'm sure, the prosecutors, with the perception of the public. Because already, from my understanding, there are some who feel as though they've already been, you know, given leniency. And not to say that that's the case, but that'll just make the prosecutors would probably even think even more through whether they want to offer a reduced plea.